Well, good morning. If we've never met before, I want to take a second to introduce myself. My name is Ben. I'm the lead pastor here at CORE. And whether you're checking us out online or here in person, we just want you to know how incredibly excited we are that you're here with us as we dive into part two of this three-part series we've been in that we're calling Anxious for Nothing. Throughout the course of this series, we are exploring some of the most difficult seasons of our lives that oftentimes feel as if they are far easier for us to simply sweep under the rug and ignore. You see, the reality is, for every single one of us, is that we have encountered moments of our lives and our stories in which it feels like we are trapped under the weight of the circumstances of our lives. And the circumstances we're walking through feel like they're suffocating us. That we feel like there's nowhere to turn and we're buried under the weight of things like fear or worry or anxiousness or even depression at the hands of a diagnosis or our health or the health of a loved one, maybe our financial situation or what we're walking through in a relationship, or maybe it's even something within our career. And in those moments, the tension that we face is that for many of us, we feel as if we are ill-equipped to know how to walk through those difficult seasons and those difficult emotions of our lives in a healthy way. That we wonder, what does it look like for us to get healthier from this point forward and for us to begin to journey through things like fear and worry and anxiety and even depression by lifting a little bit of that weight off of our shoulders? You see, for some of us, we've dealt with the weight of anxiety or the weight of depression in our lives. And it feels like the message that we have always been communicated in those seasons of our lives is it's best as if you act as if nothing is wrong. It's best as if you don't acknowledge it and acknowledge that you're walking through things like anxiety or walking through something like depression. And oftentimes we're communicated this message in such a way that we begin to believe that there must be something wrong with me. Something so wrong with me that it's not even worth talking about or acknowledging to the people around us. And so we just continue to journey through life with that same degree of brokenness and that same degree of weight on our shoulders, acting to the outside world as if everything is all right. But what if, right smack dab in the middle of this series, I told you that that just isn't fair? That it isn't fair to you, it isn't fair to me. That as the local church, we should be able to have difficult conversations about difficult things to begin to explore what a healthier present and a healthier future looks like in every single one of our lives. You see, what if I told you that around here, CORE Community Church was committed to being a place that when you walked through those back doors, you knew that this was a place where it's okay to not be okay. That if you walked in here feeling broken, feeling like your story says something about your past and your present that you would rather not a whole lot of people to know about, and you feel like because of that, you just don't fit in around here, what I want you to know is this, is that this place isn't a place full of perfect people. This is a place full of broken people in which you are fit right in, because this is a place full of broken people seeking a God who is not broken, a place full of people who don't have it all together, pursuing a God who we believe with all of our hearts does have it all together, a God who wants something better for your present and something better for your future. And that's what this series is predicated on, that if we could begin to see our God in that way and begin to believe our church can function that way, then we become people who are capable of having real, healthy conversations about difficult things that allow us to move in a healthier direction for every single one of our futures. You see, if you find yourself broken and struggling with the weight of your world or the world that seems to be pressing down on your shoulders, we just don't believe that you'll fit in around here simply because we're a group full of broken people led by a broken pastor. But we also believe that you'll fit right in because this instruction manual for our lives that God gives us is full of stories of lives of broken people just like you and I. People who didn't have it all together. Men and women who were journeying through life's difficult circumstances and battling things like fear and worry and anxiety and depression in their life every day, trying to lean into a God who did have it all together and was pursuing something better for their lives and their stories. stories. A God who wants to communicate the exact same thing he did thousands of years ago through this instruction manual directly into your story right here, right now, today. That I love you so much that no matter what you think your story, your past, your emotions say about you, that I'm a God who's looking for every opportunity possible to intersect with your story exactly where you're at. And if you want to see a life that exemplified that to a T, this battle with worry and anxiety and depression and fear and disappointment, there is no life that exemplifies that better in God's instruction manual for all lives and our journeys than the life of a guy named Paul. You see, what we know about Paul, if you've never heard of this guy before, is simply this. Paul was a guy who got a unique opportunity to write most of the New Testament. And as he wrote most of the New Testament, most of us look at that single accomplishment as something that places Paul on this pedestal. And yet when we dig into Paul's writing, what we begin to see Paul write about himself is this. Paul often referred to himself as public sinner number one. He talked about this reality in his life, and maybe some of us can relate to this. That I know the things I shouldn't do, and yet I just keep doing all the things I know I shouldn't do. And I know what I should do, but I just can't bring myself to do the things I should do. Paul wrote about this thorn that he had in his side, and scholars debate whether that was a physical ailment or a mental ailment or an emotional ailment that Paul was dealing with in his life. But what we do know for certain is that whatever it wasn't going away. And Paul had to walk with that thorn in his side and his story every single day of his life. You see, Paul knew all about the emotions that you and I are walking through in our lives and in our stories right now. The emotions of uncertainty and fear and worry and disappointment and anxiety. You see, Paul had this dream that he had placed out in front of him for years upon years. And his dream was simply this. In the land in which Paul lived, he was a part of what was the Roman Empire. And at the center of the Roman Empire was a city called Rome. And Paul had this dream that one day he would get an opportunity to journey to the city of Rome and ultimately share the hope of this God in the form of Jesus Christ, who walked onto this earth, who died on a cross and rose again to communicate this simple message that the God of the universe wants a personal relationship with you. No matter what you think your backstory says about you, no matter what wrong decisions and wrong turns you've made, a God who wants to be a part of your life and wants to walk beside you. It was Paul's desire that at some point he would walk into Rome and be able to share this hope of Jesus with thousands of people in the Roman Empire and win them to Christ and convince them of the love of Jesus that he had for them. But Paul's dream didn't end there. Paul had this dream that in winning people's, thousands of people's hearts to Christ in the city of Rome, that at some point his platform would be elevated to such a point that he would get an opportunity to present the hope of Jesus Christ, not just in front of the regular Roman citizen, but that he would also receive a platform to communicate the hope of Jesus Christ to the highest ranking Roman government officials. And ultimately, the fate of the Roman Empire and the fate of the world around it would change on a dime based upon the fact that the highest ranking Roman officials would learn about the hope of Jesus and would believe in this God who wanted something better for their present and their future. And yet, in light of this incredible dream that Paul had, instead of marching into Rome as a champion of the faith, you know that when Paul had an opportunity to go to Rome, do you know how Paul entered into Rome? He was brought into Rome in chains as a prisoner, thrown into the middle of a stinky, crummy old prison cell, and oftentimes chained 24/7 to a giant, stinky Roman prison guard. And as Paul sat there smack dab in the middle of that jail cell, wouldn't you think that all of these emotions would have been coursing through his veins? The disappointment of a dream that would never come to fruition. The uncertainty of what direction his life would take from here, or if his life would end right smack dab in the middle of this prison cell.
And yet, in light of all of the emotions that Paul should have been feeling, all of the things that he should have been struggling through, with all the disappointment and all the uncertainty and all the fear and all the worry and all the anxiety that should have been coursing through Paul's veins, somehow, as he sat there right smack dab in that prison cell, Paul decided to put pen to paper and to write a letter to Christ followers like you and like me, knowing full well, this is the incredible part, knowing full well that in our lives and in our stories, we would face similar circumstances in which we would face the death of dreams, in which we would face uncertain futures, in which we would face circumstances that weren't going the way we had planned them to go. And as Paul was sitting there in the middle of a jail cell, he decided to put pen to paper and express this one thing that we have made the launching pad for every single week of this series. And it was something that was absolutely unbelievable. Something that set a new course and a new direction for not just Paul's future, but an opportunity for something different and something better for our future 2,000 years later. In this letter to the church in Philippi, in Philippians chapter 4, starting in verse 4, Paul writes this. And I always feel like it serves us better if you can bring up the picture in your mind of Paul rotting in the middle of a jail cell. In the midst of difficult circumstances and dead dreams, this is what he chooses to write. Rejoice in the Lord always. I will say it again. Rejoice. Let your gentleness be evident to all. The Lord is near. Do not be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God. And the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your heart and your minds in Christ Jesus. You see, in this one passage, Paul does something so absolutely incredible. He makes acknowledgement, even though at face value, oftentimes we don't see it. He makes acknowledgement of his poor circumstances that he finds himself in. Because right there in like sentence number 2, what does Paul say? I need a reminder for myself that the Lord is near, that the Lord hasn't left me, that the Lord hasn't forsaken me. Even though my life hasn't turned out the way that I wanted it to or the way I dreamt it would, that God is still right here beside me, in the midst of my muck, in the midst of my mire, that he still sits right here and journeys through this junk with me. And then he gives us our title phrase, be anxious for nothing. And when we are capable of returning back to this place where in our lives we can reset ourselves and our perspective and our amount of control, we find ourselves arriving at the ultimate destination. And this is where Paul finishes, that in our lives, in our presence and in our futures, we begin to experience a peace that surpasses all understanding. We get to experience a peace in our lives that makes absolutely zero sense in light of the circumstances and the difficulties that you and I are presently walking through, or we will walk through in our future. And I don't know about you, but for me, it's like, that's what I desire. That's what I need in my life. That's what I'm searching for. But the question that rises to the surface is simply this: how is that possible? Paul, how in the midst of what you were walking through and what I'm walking through, can we find ourselves experiencing a peace that allows us to be anxious for nothing? And for many of us, the very place that our ability to experience that kind of peace goes out the window is in the major decision-making moments of our lives. Is that for many of us, there is nothing in our lives that creates more stress and tension and even anxiety and worry in our lives than the moments where we are forced to make some of life's biggest decisions. That for some of us, we find ourselves walking through, or we can look back on the not-so-distant past, and we can see the moments of our lives in which our tension level and our anxiety level has risen through the roof on the back of a decision that we had to make that we didn't know what was right. For some of us, we find it in our career. And we look at the job that we're presently in, and what we would admit is this: man, I'm not feeling all that fulfilled in what I'm doing, and I'm not so sure that this is my place of purpose. And yet here I am faced with a decision and my pay's pretty good and I've risen up the corporate ladder and I've got a place of seniority and the health benefits are about as good as they could be. And so do I take a risk of turning my back on all of that safety and all of that security to pursue the unknown and to go searching for something that could make me feel more fulfilled and could be my place of purpose? For some of us, we experience it in the purchasing process. That here we are on the precipice of purchasing our first home, and we have all these thoughts and all these dreams of what our lives could become, and we haven't had kids yet, and yet we're faced with a decision of how big of a house do we get, and how many rooms do we get in, and we haven't had kids yet, but how many are we planning to have, and should we buy it that much? And we go to the bank, and they tell us we can be pre-approved for that much. On paper, it looks like that's way too much every single month for the budget that we have, but they're telling me I can get this much, and so do we get a bigger house? Do we downsize? Do we keep it within our financial limit? For some of us, it comes to fruition within our relationships. And you're dating that guy that doesn't really love Jesus. But for the most part, he's nice to you. Except for the times where you don't give in to when he wants to have premarital sex. And sometimes you do. And do I keep pursuing this and keep giving this a chance and keep believing that I'm going to turn him around or her around? Or do I step into the unknown? Do I believe with all the fears and all the uncertainty, all the worry that God has something better for me and my future and my dating life and my marriage one day than this? Or for some of us, we sit here and there's something that lies out in front of us and we don't know what to do with our future. We don't know where we're supposed to go to school. What college are we supposed to pick? What do we want to do when we get our first big boy or big girl job? What should we major in? And God, I don't know what the next steps are supposed to be from here. And for many of us, one of the most complicated parts of life is making decisions. And if you're looking for a place to be able to recognize that very truth, you don't have to go back any further than when you first started dating that significant other in your life. Because you quickly realized how difficult decision-making was when you went on your first date and the two of you had to pick where you were going out to eat. Am I right? That you started driving in the car and all you had to do was simply pick a restaurant, and from that day till now, this hasn't dissipated within your relationship or your marriage. And it's like, we can't make a decision on where we want to eat tonight. And you look at your wife, or you look at your girlfriend or your boyfriend, and you ask, where do you want to go? And the immediate response back is, well, it doesn't matter to me. Where do you want to go? You see, for Krista and I, before we had kids, you know, kids kind of wipe all those decision-making processes away in your life. Before we had kids, every Friday night was date night for us. And so it was like this was the time on the calendar, no matter what was going on, where we were going to go out. We were going to go out to eat and have just the two of us on this night together. And on those nights, it's like week after week after week, the exact same dialogue took place. We would jump in the car, we'd drive over to the strip in Ontario where all the restaurants are, and just as we were approaching the strip, I would lean over and say, where would you like to eat tonight? And she would look back at me and she'd say, whether it was true or not, amen, guys, it doesn't matter to me, wherever you would like to eat. And it was like this standoff in the moment of, I'm not making the decision, you're going to make the decision. And so for us, this is what it looks like. We would just drive down the strip and I'm like, I ain't turning in until you make a decision. And we get to the end of the strip of the restaurants and I'd pull in and she'd think I was going somewhere. I was simply turning around to just drive back down the strip. Like, we're just going to keep doing this. It's like cruising in the 50s down the strip until you pick a place to pull into. You see, the reality is so often in our lives, well, that's a fun, small example. So often we face this crippling effect, this paralysis on the back end of the major decisions that we have to make in our lives. Unsure of how we push forward, unsure of how we lift some of that weight and some of that stress off of our shoulders and the anxiety we feel as we journey through the decisions that we're faced with every single day. And you see, the reality is that the reasons why we find ourselves so anxious in the decision-making process is really twofold. That there are two primary reasons in every single one of our lives and our stories that we find ourselves so stressed out when it comes to making decisions. The first is this. It's simply because in our lives and in our world, we have too many choices. Am I right? We live in a world where there are unlimited choices for us to make in almost every single decision that we make. And in our lives, somewhere along the way, we've been led to believe that the more choices we have, the easier it is for us to make decisions. And come on, y'all, that just isn't true. Am I right? That couldn't be further from the truth. In fact, the more decisions we have, the more stressed out we feel. And do you realize that psychologists have done countless studies on this, and what they've found is this. Psychologists have actually found that there is something that happens in the human brain called the paradox of choice. And the paradox of choice is simply this, that when our brain is faced with too many options to choose from, we actually experience cognitive impairment. Our brain begins to shut down, and as our brain begins to shut down, what happens is it stresses us out, and it leads us to feelings and emotions of unhappiness and discontentment with our lives and whatever decision we make. Isn't that crazy? The psychologists have actually done scientific studies that show this paradox of choice. When we are faced with too many choices, that our brain literally begins to shut down. And it's like this reality that in our lives, it would be far easier when we flip on Netflix if there were just two shows for us to pick from instead of a million. It's this reality that when Ben Carver was growing up, it would have been far healthier for him and a whole lot less stressful if instead of everybody telling me, you can be whatever you want when you grow up, if they would have just looked at me and been honest enough to say, let's narrow the choices a little bit. If it has to do anything with music, let's cross it off the list. If it has to do anything with power tools, not a good idea. And frankly, this is going to crush your soul. But you're too small and too unathletic. You are never going to be a professional athlete. And it would have made my life and my decision-making process a whole lot simpler. You see, self-awareness can be an incredibly useful tool to eliminate some stress in our lives as it pertains to the decision-making process. You see, studies actually show that right now in our world, the average child makes about 5,000 choices per day. Hello. And in the same study, it shows that the average adult makes 30,000 choices per day. There was study after study that kept referencing back to this exact same study that showed that amount of decisions. And then I found one study that said those numbers were wrong, and I couldn't decide which one to believe. But regardless of if we're making 30,000 choices or 5,000 choices a day, it is no wonder, y'all, we are so stressed out. It is no wonder we're feeling so much anxiety and fear and worry and even depression at the hands of the major choices and the uncertainty of what we are supposed to choose to move forward in the best way possible. You see, too many choices doesn't give us more freedom. It just introduces more paralysis into our lives. But it isn't just that it's too many choices. In fact, the second reason that many of us feel anxious in our decision making actually probably resonates with many of us a whole lot more. And it's this, is that when it comes to making decisions, we fear making a costly mistake. There is this fear inside of us that every single one of us have that is best defined as the fear of missing out. We don't want to miss out on God's best. We don't want to miss out on the best thing for our future. Gen Z calls it FOMO. And there's this reality in every single one of our lives that we believe every decision we make, if we make the wrong decision, is going to keep us from the best. And so in looking at it through that lens, we just keep standing there unsure of which way to go, and we find ourselves constantly paralyzed by the fear of making a costly mistake that will jeopardize our family or jeopardize our marriage or jeopardize our finances or jeopardize our faith. We pick up the next book on self-help when it comes to our relationship, and they just keep telling me, as a young single lady, you gotta find the right one. You gotta find the right one. You gotta find the right one. We pick up our daily devotional, and inside it, they keep talking to us about finding the purpose that God has for your life and finding that purpose that will allow you to experience contentment and fulfillment and make a difference in the world. We walk into places like this and they let some dude walk up here on stage and he keeps saying things like, you need to live your life right smack dab in the middle of God's will for what he wants for you. And as we experience all of those things, the questions that keep rising to the surface in our lives is this: what if I miss the right one? What if I don't know what my purpose is? What if I make a decision in my life that takes me out of the center of God's will and I screw everything up royally? That time and time again, out of fear, we hesitate, we stall, we procrastinate, and ultimately we become indecisive. And y'all, we all know this from the college papers we used to write that was due the next day and we waited till the night before to start it, that when we find ourselves in the midst of stalling and procrastination, it doesn't eliminate the stress, it increases the stress in our lives. And oftentimes we do that simply out of fear of making a costly mistake, of just making a decision. And so the question is this: how do we release some of that pressure and that weight that we feel from every decision of our lives? Because, Ben, it is complicated. And hear me on this. With the time that we have left this morning, I want to take us from a pattern of overcomplicating it to simplifying it. That I want to give you just one big thing and two really small things. That if we do this one big thing first and foremost, and then we choose to follow through on these two really small things, that we will begin to experience in our decision-making process a mentality that allows us to be anxious for nothing. Not five steps, not seven steps, not 10 steps, one really big thing and two really small things. And the reality is we find a path forward through a story from 2,000 years ago. A way to release the weight of the decision-making process off the backs of some dudes that 2,000 years ago had to make a ridiculously big decision. See, 2,000 years ago, when Jesus came and walked on this earth, as we talked about in communion, he set this new covenant for you and I. That everything in the Jewish faith was this old covenant that God had between him and a specific group of people. But now his son came and walked on this earth and died on a cross and rose again to set this new covenant, to wipe that away and establish something new in our lives and in our relationship with him. And yet Jesus got this brilliant idea that on the back end of establishing this new covenant, this new personal relationship that he wanted with you and I, no matter what our story said about him, that he was going to leave this world anyways and place the future of the local church in the hands of humanity. As he placed the future of the local church in the hands of humanity, something happened. They looked at this old covenant and they looked at the new covenant that Jesus came and he placed in our lives and in our relationship, and they had this dilemma. How much of the old stuff comes over into the new stuff? And ultimately, the one thing that they kept bumping into was this. Is that in a day and age, hang on y'all, don't get rosy in the cheeks on me, all right? In a day and age in which it wasn't commonplace at birth within a hospital for a baby to be circumcised, then in the ancient Jewish faith, one of the requirements was, in order for you to be clean and to have a relationship with God, as a man, you must make the decision to be circumcised. And with that, ultimately, they had this decision to make. Now that God has established this new covenant, is that something that we bring with us over to this new covenant? And side note, y'all, I sat back as I was preparing. I was like, I am so glad we are 2,000 years past this. Because, guys, it's okay. I get it. It ain't easy to walk in here today, right? Imagine if I told you in order to come in, you had to make the choice to, I'm not going to do the hand motion. You had to be circumcised. You guys would be like, there ain't no way I'm showing up for that. You had me at the beginning, you lost me in the middle there, Ben. And the reality was, is this group of guys, they came together and they decided, okay, we need to make this decision. And ultimately, this decision is so important for this reason. Because when Jesus came to this earth, he made it clear, I have come to seek and save those who are lost. That is my cause. That is my mission. That is my vision. And as the local church, you are designed to get on the back of that mission and vision as well. And ultimately, what that meant was this, is that the people they were going after to present the hope of Jesus Christ were what the Jews called Gentiles. And every Gentile man was not circumcised. This was a big deal. This was a roadblock. It was a hindrance to people coming to know Christ. And they were making a determination. Is this roadblock worth it? And we pick up this story in the book of Acts, chapter 15. And ultimately, in making this decision, this is how they went about making this major decision for the future of the local church. And I helped you out with some underlines. Then it seemed good to the apostles and the elders with the whole church to choose men from among them to send to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. So essentially, in these first two verses, what you're going to see is they begin to establish this new framework for what they're going to require within the local church. And now they're making decisions on how we spread that to the entire world. And so they're saying, okay, we've come up with this stuff. Now we're going to send messengers to Paul and Barnabas, who really, there's a reason that Paul got appointed, because all of Jesus' disciples were like, well, we're kind of more comfortable right here in Jerusalem. And God's like, I need somebody who's going to go out into all the world. And so they decide, okay, we're going to send these guys out to put the message into all the world of now this is kind of what the new covenant looks like. And so you'll see that again in a second. It seemed good to us, having become of one mind, to select men to send to you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul. For it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these essentials. And what you see come next in this passage is essentially what they do is they take all of these 613 laws and they basically simplify it down to three things. The first two we see they center around idol worship. And they're like, okay, if you're going to have a relationship with God, you can't be doing stuff with other people who come in conflict with God. You got to believe that God is God. And then the third one, they say, okay, this is a hindrance to you being in great relationship with God and pursuing the best future he has for you, is you have to put behind you the sexual immorality that you're embracing in your life. And so they basically say, okay, all the rest of it we've thrown out. Here are the three things that we're going to focus on that we believe set you up to have the best relationship with Jesus and to walk forward into the best future that God wants for you. And ultimately, what we find in this passage is this. They were making their decisions based on what seemed good? Come on, Ben, you got to tell me that it's not simplified that much. That's not where you're going with this. That they were just making every decision on a whim. It seems good. That just seems good, so let's go with it. Because the reality is every one of these dudes would have read time and time again this passage in the Old Testament that Solomon wrote. Every single one of them would have read this countless times in their life that we find in Proverbs chapter 14. There is a path before each person that seems right, but it ends in death. There's a path before each person that seems good, but that path ends in death. And the question that you and I should have is, what gives? How can both of these things be true? How can both of these things be accurate? How can there be a path before each individual that seems good and yet it's ultimately the wrong way? And yet here were these dudes who were making some of the most monumental decisions for the local church based on what seemed good. And here's where the simplification comes in. You see, the difference between these two passages is actually that I tricked you. Is that in the first passage that we read, we underlined and focused on some things that weren't the most important part of the passage. Is that ultimately within this passage, the things that we passed right over were the things that allowed them to be able to move together, to simplify it, and to begin to link arms, and to throw away their differences, and to put aside all of the things that weren't essential, and to drive forward towards the one critical thing. You see, the reality in all lives, the one simple step that alleviates the pressure of decision-making in all lives and allows us to be healthier in decision-making is simply to acknowledge this truth. That if you surround yourself with the wrong people and listen to the wrong voices and live for the wrong values, what seems right will often be wrong. If you surround yourself with the wrong people, listening to the wrong voices, and live for the wrong values, what seems right will often be wrong. And come on, y'all, we've done this in our dating relationships, right? Then in the moment with that guy or that girl, we did what felt good. We did what seemed right in the moment, only to look back after the relationship has dissipated and recognize those choices weren't right, they were wrong. We've done this in our friend groups. In the moment when surrounded by those friends, we made the decisions that felt fun. We made the decisions that felt good in the moment. And yet when the spirits have died off, you know what spirits I'm talking about? In the aftermath, we look back and we recognize that what felt good and what seemed right in the moment was actually taking us in the wrong direction. But then we have guys who built the foundation of the church on what seems good. How could they do that? How could they leave it to just that? And the reality is they weren't leaving it to just that. They were taking a very calculated approach to ensuring that they were surrounded by the right people and collectively making the decisions together. You see, I underlined some new things as we look at this passage a second time. Starting in verse 22, it says, "Then it seemed good to the apostles and the elders with the whole church to choose men from among them to send to Antioch with Paul and Barnabas. It seemed good to us, having become of one mind, to select men to send to you with our beloved Barnabas and Paul. For it seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to lay upon you no greater burden than these essentials." They were able to act on what felt right, on what seemed right, because they were surrounded by the right people, all trying to move in the right direction. The whole church was willing to simplify it down and put their differences behind them and link arms and begin to move together for a greater purpose, for a greater mission, for a greater vision that Jesus came and set precedent of. We made some decisions that felt good and felt fun, and they led us in the wrong direction until we made the decision to surround ourselves with the right people. And what I'm about to say next may be the most important thing that I say today if you call yourself a part of Core Community Church. It may be the most important thing I say for our ability collectively as Core Community Church to be able to accomplish the big things that I believe with all of my heart that God has waiting just around the corner for us. The church is not a building. You do not go to church. It is not a destination. The church has always been and will always be a people. It's not a place you go, it's an identity that you embrace. We don't go to church, we are the church. It's not something you choose to do in a one-hour gathering when you've got nothing else going on. Oh, what do you want to do this weekend? Well, the kids are back in school, so we can't go camping, and there's no soccer tournaments, so I guess there's nothing better. We'll go to church. The church wasn't something that was designed to meet all the needs of Christ followers. Well, I'm not happy because that church isn't meeting my needs. I'm looking for something different because they didn't meet my needs. Come on, y'all. I'm not sure if there could be a more unbiblical statement than that. Hang on. The church is not a building designed to meet Christians' needs. We, as Christ followers, are the church designed to meet the needs of the world. That is what God has stricken us with. That is the responsibility and the opportunity that He has given us. And if that doesn't fire us up, there is something we have missed along the way. We might as well shut the doors, y'all. I'm serious. Because it's not worth it, because we're not echoing the heart of who Jesus is and what He's called us to. You see, I believe with all of my heart, one of the biggest lies Satan wants to convince you of is that somehow you can thrive as a Christ follower outside of the organization of the local church. I just don't believe it. Because I believe with all of my heart, God knows what he's doing. And he established the local church as an entity because he understood that as we progress through life, if we become people who are capable of putting our differences behind us and linking arms together and making the most important things the most important things, that there is nothing on earth, not even the gates of hell, can stop us. That we are more powerful and more effective when we come together and we simplify it down and we move together on mission for the sake of the world. Not my needs, not your needs, for the sake of the world and the needs of the lost people within our world. That is who we are. That is the identity we have been called to embrace. And doing so in our lives ultimately allows us to charge into a hurting, broken, dark world and not feel the crippling weight of every decision of our lives. That's the one big thing. Who are you surrounding yourself with as you make decisions in your life? Are you trying to do it on your own? Are you surrounding yourself with the wrong people? Ultimately, if that's our choice, the weight intensifies on our shoulders. But when we choose the right people, we're able confidently to move forward together and recognize, sometimes even if we mess it up, we're not in this alone. But there's more. God gives us two small things. In fact, right smack dab in the middle of this passage that we read from Paul, he gives us these two tips. At the very beginning, he says, don't be anxious about anything. And at the very end, he says, you'll experience a peace that passes understanding. But right in the middle, he says, here are two small steps you can take in your daily life and your daily walk to get you from A to B, to get you from the beginning to the end, for you to experience what you are hoping to experience. And what does he say? If you reference it back in your notes, right there in verse 4, he says, don't be anxious about anything. With prayer and petition and thanksgiving, present your requests to God. What are the two small things? With prayer and with thanksgiving. That when we partake in those two things, the weight of our decisions slowly lifts off of our shoulders. And here's why. Because ultimately, do you know what prayer does? Prayer is a way for us to release control. It's an admittance as we bring our stuff and we lay it at the feet of Jesus, an admittance that, God, I can't do this on my own. I don't know what to do. I don't know what the next step is. I need your help. I need you to step in on this one. I need to know that you're walking beside me. I need you to give me wisdom. I need you to give me discernment in this. God, I'm releasing some of my control and feeling like I'll fix this, I'll make it right, to saying, God, I need you to step in to this. And ultimately, in our lives, when we release some of the control, you know what else we release? We release some of the responsibility from the outcome. Ultimately, that's what the fear of missing out comes from, is we're trying to hold so tightly to the responsibility of the outcome and how everything turns out. But when we release some control, we're saying, God, I'm trusting you with the outcome. God, I'm giving you a little bit of the responsibility or all the responsibility for the outcome, and I'm stepping back and I'm just doing what I can do, and I'm trusting that you'll do what you can do. Prayer releases control and ultimately releases stress. Secondly, thanksgiving. Do you know the one thing we do around here that falls most in line with a practice of thanksgiving? It's an opportunity we give you every single week. Worship. Because if you pay attention to any of the words on the screen, what you'll quickly find is that just about every song we sing takes the focus off of me and places a focus on who God is, what God's done, and what we believe God will do. And when we engage in thanking God for who he is and what he's done and what we trust and have faith that he will do, it changes our perspective. Our eyes shift focus off of all the crap that we're dealing with and all the things we can't control and all the weight that feels like it's pressing on our shoulders, and we place our eyes on the reality that we have a God who's already won the battle. A God who we don't have to be stressed out about what happens next week, because ultimately when my life fades, the outcome will always be the same because God has already won. That changes things, y'all. It changes the stress and the worry and the fear and the anxiousness that we grapple with every day when we return ourselves back to a heart of thankfulness and gratitude by engaging in worship and acknowledging who our God is and how much he's done for us and how much he loves us. See, the reality is this, is that with a posture of prayer and a perspective of praise, we find ourselves seeking God, and ultimately, that is when we can have confidence that we do what seems right. We seek God with everything we have. We've surrounded ourselves with the right people. We've released control. We've thanked God. And now all we can do is do what seems right and charge forward and make the next best decision. Several years ago, they came out with this new technology. It was a box with a little suction cup on the back. And every time you climbed into your car, you put that suction cup on your front windshield, and you typed in the address of the place that you were going. And if your GPS was anything like mine, maybe it's still this way on your phone, but there was this polite British lady that kept giving you directions. And as you were going towards your destination, she would come on to the screen and she would say, "Turn right now." But if you're anything like me, right, we live in a rural area. There have been far too many moments to count in which she says, "Turn right now." And you're like, "Do you mean right now or do you mean the next right? Because there's this alley here or there's this little country road and I'm not sure if that's the right that I'm supposed to take or I'm not sure if it's at the next light that I'm supposed to turn right." And it reminds me of that moment in The Office. Anybody watch The Office where Michael gets his first GPS and he's driving and the British lady says, "Turn right now." He's like, "I think I'm supposed to turn right now." And Dwight's like, "No, there's a pond over there. She means the next road." He's like, "No, she means right now." And he drives his car right smack dab into the middle of the pond. And it's like, I don't know what right I'm supposed to take. I don't know what decision I'm supposed to make next. What if I make a wrong turn? And the reality is, Paul probably felt a little like this. He looked at himself sitting right there in the middle of that jail cell, and he thought, somewhere along the way, I must have taken a wrong turn. Because how did my life turn out this way? And yet, if we rewind, we see something incredible. In Philippians chapter 1, verse 12, at the very beginning, as Paul is sitting in the middle of that jail cell, he writes this, "But I am convinced that all of these things have happened to me so that I could make Christ's name more known." Somewhere along the way, by surrounding himself with the right people and prayer, and a constant perspective of thanksgiving and praise in his life, Paul was able to find confidence, regardless of his decisions, regardless of his circumstances, in a God that stands on this truth. And we believe that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him and are called according to his purpose. Feeling stressed about the decisions you have to make, or maybe the decisions that you have made. And you look at some of the decisions you've made in your past and you walked into this place firmly believing that those decisions have doomed your future. See, if that's you, can I just finish by speaking something over you? That if you feel like the decisions of your past ultimately have doomed your future, you're giving yourself too much credit. Because we have a God who is in the business of taking wrong turns and turning them into something good. A God much like the British lady on your little GPS screen, that when we make the wrong turns, simply sees it as an opportunity to say, "Rerouting. I'm going to work trying to reroute you to the very best I want for your life and your future." Our God has a way of bringing about good things out of every wrong turn. Don't overcomplicate it. Surround yourself with the right people and keep moving on what seems right. And trust that we have a God who in your life, in your decisions, never deems you too far gone. A God who continues to move in the aftermath of every wrong turn.
And when we cling to that, that's when we begin to realize, even in the midst of life's biggest decisions, how we can become people who are anxious for nothing. Would you pray with me? Father, this morning, God, we thank you for being a God who loves us, is for us, pursues us, and wants what's best for us. But God, in lifting some of the weight and stress and fear and anxiety off of our shoulders and walking into your best, sometimes it requires the hard choices of choosing to surround ourselves with the right people, to have a posture of prayer and to release some control, and to have a perspective of praise in which we turn our eyes from our own junk into who you are. God, we thank you for being a God who promises us, no matter what we're walking through, no matter how many wrong turns we've made, who promises us that we are still within reach of a peace that surpasses all understanding if we're willing to take the right steps. We thank you for that. It's in your name that we pray.